Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Douglas Bell. Today, we'll be talking with Lou Roberts, the Wharf Distinguished Lucy Abrach Professor and Plannert Boscom Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We'll be talking to her today about her new book, Sheer Misery, Soldiers in Battle in World War II, published by the University of Chicago Press. Professor Roberts, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Lou, would you mind by beginning the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself and also how you came to write this book?
Sure. So I've been a professor at Wisconsin for almost 20 years, and my work in the last three books has shifted to the Second World War. And I wrote a book called What Soldiers Do, which was about relations between the United States infantry and French women. And when I was reading that book, reading autobiographies for that book, I read a lot of GI memoirs. I noticed that they really were very different from officer memoirs. Officer memoirs are often about strategy, military strategy, tactics, the sort of logic of the battle. And the infantry memoirs I read were very different. They were very embodied. The story was really about the senses, seeing, hearing, smelling. And it was also about physical discomfort, being cold, being hot, being dirty, having wet feet and wounding, all these things. So I thought, well, I'm going to write a history of the body in the war, or more precisely, the somatic experience of infantry. And I decided to do it broadly. So I read memoirs and autobiographies of British, German, French, and American soldiers. There are less French and German soldiers, I noticed, because of very complicated reasons. The Americans are obviously the biggest whiners. The British come in second. But the German memoirs were mostly on the Eastern Front, only about 20% on the Western Front. I was doing Western Europe. And they did not have so much complaints about them. Remember, at this time, I'm writing 44, 45, the Germans are losing really badly. And so I didn't find as many in Germany. And for the French, you know, I literally went through and read every single memoir in the Library of Congress. But they're also less miserable, because I think in 44, 45, the French infantrymen really wanted to prove his courage, having had experienced defeat in 1940. So there was some physical stuff, but it was really more about honor and courage and things like that. So it was interesting how the embodied experience in the memoir was measured by many different things. Obviously, German culture versus American culture, German Stoicism, but also who was winning, who was losing, who had lost, and who had won. So I just did all four, and that was how I came up with the book.
Yeah, great. Well, it was really fascinating. I thought there were some wonderful insights into the book.
Thank you.
So you start by looking at the senses and what the senses meant. So in the first one is sound. So what were the sounds that soldiers heard on the battlefield, and how did it make them feel, or how did they describe them?
Mm-hmm. Well, the hearing was the most important sense on the battlefield, because in a war in which artillery is a crucial place, and artillery positions are out of sight and being determined by location, to see the enemy was to be vulnerable to the enemy. So the sounds of war became really more important than they had in other wars. And the reason was that sound became a way for soldiers to locate themselves on the battlefield. They became experts at the sounds of different kinds of weapons. They knew in terms of artillery, what shot is headed right towards them and one was going to go over them. They knew about the difference between German machine guns and American machine guns. They used them strategically to locate themselves on the battlefield. The noise of war also measured the distance from the front. If the front was extremely, if you were in a very noisy place, you were close to the front. If you were in a place where you could only hear the war distantly, you were not near the front. So in some ways, noise demarcated the space of the battlefield. And the artillery that the Americans and the Allies and the Germans used was terrifying in a new way. It was much more powerful and much more accurate than similar weaponry in First World War. So it was something soldiers had to get used to. When you first got to the front, it was so noisy that you couldn't sleep. And only after a while could you learn to sleep with this amount of noise. So in some ways, a soldier's tolerance of sound took the measure of his time on the front line.
Yeah, great. So one of the interesting things that I liked when you talked about sound was the ideas of how more experienced soldiers passed on the idea of sound to newer replacements. How did this kind of what do I want to say? That I really found that interesting, in how this kind of helped build a connection between older and replacement soldiers, because you often read about or hear about how replacements weren't fairly welcomed, but there was also this veterans were trying to educate the newer soldiers as they were coming in.
No, it's true that in some ways sound helps build community, because when replacements came on the line, it was complicated for the veterans, and by veterans I mean somebody who's been there 3 months, right?
Right.
So there was a lot of teaching of sound, teaching younger replacement soldiers, okay, that's an artillery that's coming towards you. Okay, that's an artillery that's not coming towards you, et cetera. So it created a sense of pride among the veterans, but it also created bonds between replacements and veterans.
So unlike sound, which had this important survival role and helped build this community, smell didn't really. So what were the smells of war that soldiers often described?
Well, there is a difference between sound and smell. And the big difference was sound told you something was coming, and smell told you something had come and gone. And what most interested me about smell was that it transcribed the chaos of the war. The smell of the battlefront was a combination of cordite and burning flesh. And so it transcribed the cause and effect of violence in that way. So it was a mixed smell, which combined both the smell of weaponry and the smell of its effects, which is, you know, sort of burning flesh. So that was one whole thing, the source of destruction and its effects, the chaos of war. But there were other smells that were infamous, and people, even now veterans, tell me they understand this. One was that we, unlike sound, we don't have a moral stigma which is attached to sound, but we do have a moral stigma that's attached to smell. And it's often been associated with racial and class differences. You know, George Orwell famously said, you know, you can tell the working class because they smell. Mm-hmm. So there was a moral stigma to this. And the worst moral stigma was attached to a very familiar smell on the front lines, which was diarrhea, that many GIs or other Allied soldiers had a terrible problem with their bowels. This is when it became, the runs became the GIs. and so the smell of shit was everywhere on the front line. And, you know, men used it to denigrate the enemy. Like, oh, those Germans smell horrible. But they also supported each other in the smell. You know, we know what's happening. You know, or some men either had digestive problems or they shit their pants out of fear. So that was another whole complex of smell that was associated with fear and humiliation, but also, again, a source of male bonding. There was one story where some soldier, American soldier, shit himself in fear. And his fellow buddies helped him clean up, threw away the underwear, cleaned his pants in the stream, got him all set up, and then they never talked about it again. So it was another way in which community got built, like sound.
Yeah. Wow. So moving to taste, one of the your focuses on taste is the rations, and they were notoriously disliked. But you go deeper into not just like that they tasted bad, but you know what the soldiers thought about them and how they talked about them to each other, and kind of, again, how they built community around this taste.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing that brings together people than complaining about something, right? Right. There were two kinds of rations, K rations and C rations. and they were meant to be portable. And then if the soldiers were someplace more stationary, they would have a cook who became a very beloved person. And they were obsessed with food. I mean, even a casual glance at some of the soldiers' division newspapers talked about, you know, we had lamb chops last night. You know, there was just an obsession about it. Because when you think about it, if you're living in a foxhole out in the middle of nowhere, you know, no luxury hotel, food becomes really, you know, there's no accepted mode of sexual expression. You know, food becomes a very important source of pleasure, perhaps the only one. So I think it made it more important at the same time as it made it more difficult to eat K and C rations. There were three types of C rations, three different meat kinds. And, you know, I went and read the quartermaster reports about this, and they said, well, one was not well received. But it was the one that one GI said something like, you know, only if you're dying of hunger, if you're literally famined, or you are completely perverse, only then can you eat it. And, you know, really, I try, you know, we always think about hospital food and army food is generically horrible. So I tried to think of how I could explain why it was so bad. And when you think about it, it had to be transported all over the world. So it had to be portable and it had to be either dehydrated or canned. None of which is good, right? No fresh food. And also, what the quartermaster people did was they tried to keep it as bland as possible to not offend any ethnic tastes. And they also were not, taste was not actually the ultimate or chief goal. The chief goal was energy. So for example, chocolate bars. They contracted with Hershey to make chocolate bars, but they made them only as tasteful as a baked potato, quote unquote. Because if they made it as tasteful as a regular Hershey bar, people would eat them up really quickly. And so they wanted them to be less tasteful so they would eat them slowly. So those are some of the reasons why the food tasted so bad.
Yeah, that's really, the potato thing was really fascinating. I had not heard that before.
Yeah.
And it really also made me think about some of the things that I had read I wrote a bit about Americans hunting in Germany after World War II, and you find stories of them talking about, even during the war, and they're shooting to go try to hunt a deer, and so that they could have something else to eat besides their rations.
Yeah. Well, some German soldiers, if they became prisoners, they couldn't believe that sea rations, they complained about them and said, you know, we need to have the same food as you for conventions. And then the GIs had to say, well, you know, actually, this is the same. They believed that they actually all ate this food. So, and of course, the French were like, when they got the K rations, the C rations, they were like, oh, my God. Abominable, you know. So yeah, they had a reputation for bad food.
So let's talk about dirt. And I like how you begin talking about this by talking about how militaries are obsessed with dirt. But can you talk about why they are?
Yeah, sure. I got interested in Bill Mauldin, the great World War II cartoonist. And it made me sort of think about the dirty body, which is, you know, Mauldin was famous for Willie and Joe, these two GIs, American GIs, and they were both completely filthy all the time. So I thought a lot about what that meant, what Mauldin was trying to do. I begin that chapter with an argument between Patton and Mauldin. And Patton wants Mauldin's very popular Stars and Stripes cartoon, Willie and Joe, out. Okay. And so Eisenhower really believed that the GIs should have some independence in terms of Stars and Stripes. So the upshot was they sent Mauldin out to meet Patton. And of course, Patton said, if that son of a bitch enters the Third Army region, I'm going to kick his ass out. So Mauldin was, you know, clean to a polish and sent out. And Patton just hated the cartoon because of the men's sloppy, dirty appearance. And he called it treachery. Lack of discipline, it means basically we're betraying the United States Army and joining with the Germans. So that conversation really intrigued my curiosity, and I began to think from there why militaries are obsessed with cleanliness. The British, in some ways even worse than the Americans. I went and read sort of military training manuals and their obsession with dirt. Also looking at, again, memoirs and autobiographies that talk about basic training, where how you made your bed, you know, how you had your so-called kit in British terms, you know, your uniform had to be perfect, or it was like, ruined your commander's day. And I think the obsession comes from a number of things. I think it's a way for military commanders in basic training to gain complete control over a soldier's body. These manuals talked about, you know, everything from cleaning your scrotum to taking balls at a certain time of day and wiping yourself. And it was clear that the army needed complete possession over the soldier's body, because after all, he's eventually going to have to put himself in harm's way at the soldier's command. I also think it's connected to orderliness. That's a bedrock military principle. And dirt means basically that something is out of place. Something is disorderly. I think it was a function of discipline and orderliness, which are the bedrocks of an army. And I also think that, like smell, dirt is connected with moral depravity. It's a slur that's often used against race, racial, and class hierarchies. The working class mm-hmm. is dirty, therefore they smell. A common anti-Semitic slur was dirty Jew. And also prejudices against Africans as being dirty in their skin. That's why they were dark. Really beginning in the early 19th century in liberal societies, cleanliness becomes, my mother was English, she always used to say cleanliness is next to godliness. So that says it all. So I think that's why militaries were obsessed with dirt.
Right. So if they're obsessed with dirt and Patton wants soldiers to be clean because it shows they're good soldiers and orderly soldiers, How did the frontline soldiers come to embrace being dirty, to being Willie and Joe?
As Bill Malden said, you can't fight the enemy with Queensbury rules. This is, at least in Western Europe, a very dirty, operation, military operation. It began really, the dirtiness began in the Italian mountains during the winter of 43-44, where soldiers were literally sometimes up to their waists in mud, and they were crossing rivers all the time as well, or they were living in the mountains where even to shave caused them to use water, which was an incredibly short supply. So in the Italian campaign really was born Willie and Joe. Malden himself was in that. He was a member of the infantry, and he got his start writing drawing for the 36th Infantry Division newspaper. And the 36th was in the muck in 43, 44. I think at first the average soldier had a double reaction to this. One, because no commanders were really coming up the mountain, they didn't have to deal with the so-called chicken shit of being perfectly clean all the time. Mm. And they used the water to drink rather than to wash themselves because they knew the commanders were not going to come up. So there was a kind of, sort of subversive element to this. Right. But I think also because in their culture, in Western culture, both British, Western Europe, and certainly in the United States, again, dirt is connected with moral depravity. There was a certain amount of shame these soldiers felt being so stinky and so on and so forth. And they were seen often as criminals. One of Malden's inspirations was he was in Naples. And the soldiers would come for their leave off the mountain, and they were so filthy and dirty and smelly that they would be imprisoned for 3 days, literally treated as criminals. And then the third day they would shower and get new uniforms and go back to the mountain. So that connection between dirt, moral depravity, and criminality, which is so embedded in Western liberal society, was at work. And that was when Malden decided, I'm going to write about the dog face, as he called him, that dirty face also mm-hmm. began in Italy. And so what I think Malden did that was so important was that he sort of transformed the meaning of dirt. In his cartoons, the dirty soldier is the real soldier, and the pristine officer is the sissy who hasn't really seen war. So Willie and Joe become heroes because of their dirt. Dirt becomes in some way the measure of the true soldier. So he turns dirt from a mark of shame and moral depravity to a mark of heroism. He sanctifies dirt. That's what his achievement is. And he finds a way for dirty soldiers to feel good about their dirt as opposed to ashamed. And so I think that's why the cartoon was so popular. And despite Patton being dead set against Malden, and Malden took him on a lot. There are a lot of cartoons in the book about how Malden takes on Patton. The cartoonist was so popular up and down the line. He was conceived as the sort of infantryman's hero. So the cartoon was never canceled. It was never taken away.
Yeah, I really like that. And again, this distinction between the real soldier and the commanders behind the lines, and descriptions you have of officers behind the lines buying or trying to get old, beat up clothing so that they can also be a quote unquote real soldier.
Yeah, no, it's true. Like replacements would get on the line and they would feel uncomfortable because their uniforms were so clean, and so. You know, they would buy from the infantrymen veterans, you know, these, and Malden made fun of these, said, and if you can have a jacket with a genuine bullet hole in it, you know, you're going to make a lot of money. So, you know, obviously, of course, it was a loss of control for commanders that suddenly everybody wants to have the Malden look. Yeah.
So dirt, another thing related to hygiene and dirt was the foot and trench foot. And so you really talk especially about how susceptible Americans were to this problem. Can you describe maybe why the Americans were particularly susceptible to trench foot?
Yeah, sure. So trench foot came about in the First World War, and it was seen as a disease of the trenches. And the British trenches in particular. And basically what trench foot is when you immerse a foot in water for a long time, and it's got to be water that is not frozen, but almost frozen, cold water. What happens is your foot starts to lose circulation. It literally shuts down. So the blood no longer circulates in your foot. And so what happens is you get swollen black feet. And then if it gets particularly bad, you get gangrenous feet. And many, many soldiers had to have their feet amputated because of this. So that was what happened for the British. So when the British in the Second World War came back, they built incredibly good boots. They were made of leather with leather heels, and they also figured out how to buff them in such a way that they were truly waterproof. Now, this wasn't true of the Americans, who had never dealt with trench foot in the First World War, mostly because it was a very short deployment. Less than 6 months. Their boots were, and again, I went and looked at the quartermaster reports on this, as well as personal, there are endless personal complaints about the boots. Mm. And even the quartermaster had to admit they were rubber soles rather than leather soles. And the rubber was recycled rubber because rubber was being used for so many other things like jeeps and tanks and things like that. So you had reconstructed rubber rather than leather heels, and they just leaked like crazy. They really did. And it's kind of a dirty little secret. You know, when I showed this chapter, it's called The Foot, to some military men, they just did not believe that because the line on American supply was that there was no problem whatsoever, right. That mm-hmm. the Americans were so well supplied. So there are bad boots. And, really, again, the quartermasters tried very hard to make them better, but failed. And the reason is, rather than redo the boot, they didn't have the materials to sort of recast the boot. They created sort of like plastic things you put on top of the boots. Hmm. But the problem there was that it was a rear echelon problem. The boots would arrive in the ports, like Naples or later on, in Brittany or Normandy. And those people who had access to these boots would take them. And so the infantry is off fighting the war, are the last to get them. And by the time they got to the infantry, you could get size 5 or you could get size 16, but the average 9, 10, 11, they couldn't get. And when the army found out about this, it really did make attempts to keep some of the people who were both unloading the ship, but also the officers in the echelon from taking them. They literally gave them a quota, but it didn't work. So oftentimes the galoshes, as they were called, never arrived. So all these things were factors of why trench foot became a problem. And then one more thing, which is really interesting, is that unlike the British, the Americans deployed their troops on the front lines for much longer. So, after 3 days, most British troops were going back, whereas the Americans would be there for weeks or at least mm-hmm. 2 weeks. So that just gave the foot longer time to get swollen. Okay.
Right. And I like how in the book you discuss a lot that this was partly, as you just mentioned, an equipment problem, and partly a deployment, how long they were in the lines. But the generals and the commanders, as they did with hygiene, blamed this on the soldiers themselves. Can you talk a little bit about this relationship, why they blame the soldiers and what the soldiers are actually going through, and why this is maybe a failure more of command rather than of supply?
Sure. The commander's explanation, and here I used NARA documents. I actually read things, reports from Patton and other generals mm-hmm. who were experiencing a lot of trench foot. They thought it was a question of discipline, that the men were not taking their socks off enough or their wet boots. And that if they only did that, then, so it was a blame the soldier kind of strategy, just to sort of not blame themselves or be blamed themselves. And of course, this absolutely infuriated the GIs. Mm-hmm. There was one, I think, Time magazine or some large American magazine, which, talked about this, if the soldiers would only take better care of their feet, and they're thing was, well, when you're crossing a river or you're in a wet trench, how can you possibly do that? Change your socks, and your socks mm-hmm. get wet right away anyways. And so one soldier said, well, okay, I'll change my socks twice a day. And at 3 o'clock every day, I'm going to have milk and cookies too, because that's good for me. They just couldn't believe that they were being blamed for this. Mm-hmm. Particularly insulting pictorial editorial in Stars and Stripes, I think, epitomizes their treatment. It was a picture of 2 feet with a gorgeous pinup on them. And it basically mimicked masturbation. It said, what I want you to do is to put your feet in these boots, so you're next to these women, these pinups, which were commonly used for masturbation. And I want you to rub them and rub them until they burst. They're so full of blood that they burst, I mean, it's hilarious. And demeaning, that they would use pinups, on a footprint and expect, soldiers to cut this out of the newspaper, put them in their boots, and then, think about the pinups as they're rubbing their feet until they're so full of blood that they're well. So The larger point here for me is a thread that runs throughout the book is the difference between the way Command sees the soldier's body and the way the soldier sees himself and his body. For Command, I use the notion of manpower. Like when Patton writes about this, his concern is that Trenchfoot is going to cause a serious reduction in manpower. And I venture that for someone like Patton, manpower looks at the soldier and the soldier's body as an abstract unit of violent force, okay? Because manpower is like horsepower, right? It measures energy, it measures force.
Right.
And so for many of these commanders, they really saw the soldier's body as a unit of violent force. And they had to, you know, I mean, Patton, for example, I read his diary and he had to abstract them in order to send them to their death. That's right. Just what a commander has to do. He can't think too much about the human side of it. The diary entry was Patton going into a hospital and seeing all these injured soldiers and saying to himself, I can't do this too much because I'll become a terrible commander if I have to think too much about these wounded bodies. But for the soldier, he's thinking about it from his own perspective, right? From his own body. So Trenchfoot is something which is happening to his body, and he's not abstract to himself at all. So there's a clash there between command and soldier and how they're looking at the body. That runs throughout the book, commander's abstraction of the soldier's body and the very embodied experience that the soldier is having.
Yeah, I think that comes out really clear. So the Trenchfoot is in some ways kind of like a wound that takes you off the line. And in the next section, you move more into actually looking at wounds, and wounds are, you know, just a fact of war. But not all wounds come from the enemy. Some soldiers wound themselves. Mm-hmm. So can you talk maybe a bit about the different types of wounds and how soldiers classified wounds? And I thought that was all really fascinating.
Yeah, so I did a chapter on wounds because I think that's the most, pain from wounds. And my experience reading popular military histories is that wounds are always sensationalized. People like Rick Atkinson will pick the most gory, you know, and his eye came out or his entrails were all over, you know. It becomes a sort of color rhetoric, rhetoric of color in military narratives. But something like, and I did only the British for this chapter because although I researched the American medical system, I just couldn't do both. So I focused on the British. But most British, 80% of British soldiers had mundane wounds. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to desensationalize the wound. And I also wanted to think about what it meant to soldiers. And I quickly discovered that they did. They had a hierarchy of wounds I think it was a coping mechanism, right, to organize wounds as a way to cope with their danger. And it also became, again, community building. People talked about wounds. So there were two or three wounds you just couldn't get, okay? Mm-hmm. No one wanted to go home without their genitals.
Right.
Okay? Yeah. That was just like the number one thing. They'd rather die than go home without their genitals. They were really afraid of the burns received by men in tanks. So the way tank warfare would occur, it was very frequent for tanks just to go up in flames if it was hit by an 80-millimeter, German 80-millimeter. Mm-hmm. And so then the guys would try and get out of the tank, but they were horribly burned. So that was a serious fear, particularly, obviously, people in armor. And then the other really dreaded wound was blindness. So I think the other half of this really makes it more sense, which is wounds you want to get. Remember that wounds were a ticket off the line.
Right.
They were, a way out of the line. And getting wounded was hard for some soldiers because they didn't want to leave their buddies. You know, they wanted to keep on fighting, but there were a lot of soldiers who just really wanted to get wounded. But they didn't want to get terribly wounded. Like, blindness took too much away. Mm-hmm. And every army had a name for a good wound, a wound that got you off the line. For the Americans, it was the $1 million mm-hmm. wound. Typical Americans, right?
Right.
And for the British, it was the Blighty wound. And Blighty is a name for London. So it meant you were going to go back to London with a Blighty wound. So everybody wanted a Blighty wound or a $1 million wound. Mm-hmm. So I just found that really interesting that they wanted to be wounded, but they didn't want to be too wounded. And blindness was too wounded. That made you war's waste. You know, you were, because you would never be able to live a normal life. So ideally, you didn't want a wound in your trunk. You know, like a $1 million wound would be an arm, you know, or a leg, right? But not your trunk, because that required surgery, and sometimes it required immediate surgery, which was really difficult to get. So, yeah, I think it was a way of organizing danger. And I found it fascinating that they did that. And they sat around and talked about it a lot. Again, creating a kind of community.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. And I also really enjoyed talking reading about how you also looked at how medical personnel in the British military also kind of thought about and communicated wounds. And you write that soldiers became their wounds in going through the medical system. So wondering if you could maybe talk a bit about that process.
Sure. Like the way the chapter is structured, I start with how soldiers think about wounds. And then I think of wounding and wounding stories that soldiers tell. And then I show how the wound changes in meaning as it goes into the British medical system. And it causes a lot of stress in the British medical system, because they have to go through this sorting, which is called triage, which is a French word from the Napoleonic Wars. They become their wound in the sense that they're not identified as individuals. So if you have a head injury, you're a head. And if you have an abdominal wound, you're an abdominal. So it's sort of an interesting change in terms of how wounds gain meaning. At first, they're very much embodied experiences, but then in the eyes of medical experiences, they're abstracted and you become your wound. You become a head or an abdominal or a leg. They literally call them that, you know, you're a leg. So I found that was very interesting in how doctors abstracted bodies enough in order to cure them and help them. Because again, that kind of personalization is antithetical to good medical care. That's why surgeons never operate on their own families.
Right, yeah.
That was the kind of abstraction that went on in the medical system, which I think is a different kind of abstraction of the body that commanders did, but still abstractions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also really enjoyed how you talked about like with soldiers on the front line in the command, that the surgeons in London also were not, they kind of looked down on the work done by their colleagues who were in the field under pressure, and that really, I thought that also was really the kind of a great link in the book as well, seeing these different places.
Yeah, that, okay, there were field surgeons, and then there were like surgeons back in London.
Yeah.
The field surgeons, with the process of triage, they have to make really, really hard, decisions, who's going to get their life saved and who's not.
Yeah.
And sometimes they made mistakes, you know, people who could have been saved weren't, and it really, for them, for those doctors, it was really about amount of time it's going to take to cure the wound and versus the possibility of survival. So if they get a man who's very severely wounded, probably won't survive even after 4 hours of surgery, and they're going to pass that guy over for somebody else. And then really the surgery that they're doing in field hospitals is, what we would call crisis care, right? They're just trying to keep the soldier from losing more blood. It's about blood transfusion or plasma transfusions, which was a huge medical advancement in the Second World War, and fighting infection, and it wasn't until December of 1944 that penicillin became available. And even then it was not that available because they didn't know how to make it synthetically. So they had to make it in huge moldy vats, literally. That's how they made penicillin. Wow. So even though the military had priority, they, so mostly they fought with sulfa drugs. So that was their, their whole goal, field surgeon's goal, was save lives and stop the bleeding, intensive care to see. And then sometimes they would not even close the wounds because they were not sure that they had gotten everything or cleaned everything out. And so the tut-tut surgeons in London would look on these and say, this is really bad technique and this is a really bad surgery. And we're just going to have to start all over again, and the field surgeons would respond, well, you're just lucky that they're alive still, because that's what we did. So it was this really interesting frontline back rear echelon division, not unlike infantry and commander, that took shape in the medical system.
Yeah. Like wounds, the corpse, the dead body is also just a fact of war. And like the wound, it was also not supposed to be seen. The task of burying bodies, and here you talk about the grave registration service in the U.S. Army, was one of the main focuses of this chapter on the corpse. And can you talk about this or part of the army and what they did? I found this to be really fascinating. I wanted a whole book on this.
The interlibrary loans on this chapter were hilarious, like memoirs, how I buried the dead. I think the librarians thought I'd really flipped out. the first chapter is about the senses, the second's about mold and the dirty body, the third chapter is about the foot, the fourth chapter is about wounds, and this chapter is about the dead body, okay? Mm-hmm. And actually it was the one I wrote first, because at the same time that I was doing What Soldiers Do, I got really interested in this whole problem of what do you do with dead bodies? Like, I had no idea. So I got interested in that first, and then I got interested again in other things about the body. The Graves Registration Service starts in the First World War. In the Civil War, there's a wonderful book about it by Drew Gilpin Faust. Soldiers were forced to bury the dead themselves. So after a battle, soldiers would bury their friends. But the amount of death in the First World War, which was a result of the enormous increase in the intensity and destructive power of weaponry, meant that there were so many dead bodies on the Western Front that they just couldn't cope, the British and the Americans, with something. So they created an institution, it's part of the army, called Graves Registration. And so that was the agency, the government agency, that would come in after a battle and sweep, as they called it, the battlefield. And what they meant by that was to clean the bodies clean the bodies off the field. And the major aim of that was to remove bodies before the next wave of soldiers came along, because they felt that if they saw, hundreds of bodies lying around, that it would be, not great for morale, right? And would also, increase intensity. So Normandy was a real challenge because, remember, it's an invasion from the sea. And immediately, the beaches, Omaha, Nebraska Beach, as well as the British beaches, are overrun with corpses. Okay. Yeah. 3,000 people died that one one day. But they hadn't yet conquered the inland. So they had some idea of where they would, but it was just still German occupied.
Right.
So they quickly got behind schedule, essentially, right, with the dead bodies. So this was part of the army which did this task from this moment in Normandy to, the victory in Berlin. Not surprisingly, it was mostly done by African-American soldiers. And the reason was that first African-American soldiers were not given combat roles. They did service roles. So this was part of, they did laundry and food and they carried supplies to the front. So this was considered part of that service role. But also in terms of racial hierarchies, they were considered, the ones that were going to do the dirtiest jobs. And there's not much dirtier than picking up a dead body. And so what did actually they do? They literally put them in mattress covers. And the reason they did that was coffins were too expensive to make and they took up too much room. You could put a lot of dead bodies in mattress covers and put them on a truck. And then the other thing they did before they put them in the mattress covers was that they took away their so-called effects. That was the term for it, their belongings. Mm-hmm. I hate the term because it's so abstract, classically, right? The effects of a body. And that meant like everything from cigarette lighters and wallets to coins, pictures of people back home, diaries, letters, etc. And those were all sent to St. Louis. And the reason they were all sent to St. Louis was because the railway system at that point was so strong for St. Louis. Now it's decayed. And so they could send things to St. Louis easily from both the East Coast and the West Coast, the European Theater and Pacific Theater. Mm-hmm. And then they were cleaned at that point. So pornographic stuff was eliminated. Everything was cleaned of blood. And if they couldn't clean it of blood, they wouldn't send it home. And then I have read for every soldier who died in the American Army, there's a file in the military articles for how he died and his effects and so on and so forth. The family had the choice of either having him buried permanently in Europe or bringing him home at the end of the war. So I have that correspondence. And then I also have correspondence from families saying, hey, you know what? We finally got his effects. There's nothing here, you know? Well, the reason was that all along the line, things were getting stolen by, commanders, by other soldiers, by graves registration, people in St. Louis. So that was the process of burying bodies.
How did soldiers, the frontline soldiers themselves, understand and make meaning of the corpse as they were, fighting the war? Their friends, their colleagues, their buddies are getting shot. They're also shooting at other people. But so how did they kind of make meaning of these?
Actually what my chapter on the dead body is about, it was originally titled Five Ways to Look at a Body. It's about what the body meant to all the people who were involved. So for example, for graves registration, it was a job. They had to figure out, oftentimes German corpses would have, prized possessions like Lugers and, German weaponry and stuff. And the GIs would so often steal those that the Germans started booby trapping the bodies. You take your Luger and you pay for it with your life. So graves registration often had to drag these bodies. So that they would detonate before they got close to them. So the graves registration, it was about technique, right? It was a job and it was a humiliating job. It was, it was a bad job. For the French, for example, they would look at an American body and they would think this man died for our freedom, you know, so that there were all kinds of really touching tributes made to dead American bodies. Flowers were put on them at great risk by French citizens. They were very meticulously covered, whereas German bodies would be just left to rot, and then children would take everything off of them. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever robbed an American corpse in Normandy. And then for the GIs, it was very complicated. How did GIs think about these corpses? It was a bunch of stuff. I think when GIs looked at the most simple level, when they looked at bodies, they understood the precarity of their own existence on the front. You know, they realized, hey, you know, this is what it came. You know, we're playing for keeps here on the front line. And it didn't really matter that much if it was a German or an American soldier. You know, they just saw these really, I mean, by 1944-45 in Normandy, there are, 14 and 15-year-olds fighting for Germany. So, you know, soldiers, GIs looked at that and thought, geez, you know, this is not a good idea. I got to watch myself. So that was one thing. But the more complicated reaction, and this explains the story I read at the, and I wrote, I finished the book with a story was, again, there's this tension in the book throughout the thread, which is the theme, is the way in which, again, the army command abstracts the body and the person. And soldiers themselves saw themselves as people and saw their buddies as people. So there's that conflict between how the army saw them and how soldiers saw them. And I think when GIs looked at bodies, they thought of that conflict, because on the one hand, if you've ever seen a dead body, you know that the person's not there anymore. It's a body. So it's weird because the person is there, but he's not there. I think that sort of ambiguity was the ambiguity of how they felt being in the army, that they were a person that was there, but they weren't there. They were sort of an abstracted body to the United States Army. So I end the book with this story that was incredibly moving to me, which was told by a surgeon named Brendan Phipps, who was with the infantry moving across Germany in 1945 at the front lines. And one morning, there is a soldier named Wally who's been shot to death. And his body happens to be in the road. And so there's all this, you know, equipment moving forward as the front retreats deeper and deeper into Germany. And he's by the side of the road waiting for Graves registration to come and pick him up and put him in a mattress cover and so on and so forth. A German woman comes over and she spits on the body and, you know, says some insulting thing. And then that's sort of a breaking point for this one infantryman. And he goes and he says, you know what we're going to do? We're going to carry Wally and we're going to bury him. So like six or seven infantrymen come over and they lift up Wally and they start taking him to be buried someplace. And of course, command gets involved. As Brendan Phipps said, you know, this is a wonderful, decent thing, and I'm pretty sure the Army is not going to like it. And sure enough, before, I can't remember, it was a captain or a lieutenant, somebody came over and said, all right, stop. You know, you can't do this. Graves registration is going to do this. And, you know, if you do it, you're all going to be court-martialed. Well, this group of infantrymen are like, court-martial? Sounds good to me. You know, I get a good meal, you know, I'm someplace safe. Mm-hmm. And they realized, you know, look, we're just pins on the map to these guys. Right. We're the ones who are making the sacrifice here. You know, these guys are staying back and they're not in the line of fire, and we are. So we're going to do this. And so they continue, and then they get to this beautiful field of flowers, red, white, and blue. And they just lay Wally down in the field, and his body disappears into the flowers. And then they all, by this time, it's not just six guys. It's like the entire half of the company, 50, 60 guys. They all say goodbye to him, and they say prayers. And some who knew him came up and say goodbye to him personally. And I think that's a perfect example of what I'm talking about, that they knew that Graves registration would come and, you know, take the dog tag, put him in a mattress cover, take his effects. But it was all very abstract to these guys, right? It was not a person. He was not a person. He was there, but he wasn't there, right? Just like any dead body. But they knew Wally as a person. And so they were going to honor him with a real burial. And the Army was against it. And the last lines Fibb says is something like, you know, probably tonight or tomorrow, he'll, you know, get taken by Graves registration and they'll put him in the long assembly line that got him here. So to me, for the GI, the dead body meant both, you know, the abstraction that the Army had made him, that he was there but not there, but at the same time, the deeply personal feelings they felt about each other and their own precarity. So that's why I ended it with that story.
Yeah, it was really powerful.
Yeah, it's a powerful story, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, Lou, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I'm really appreciative.
Sure.
We end every interview by asking the same question, so I'll ask you, and that is, what are you working on next?
Yeah. Well, actually, I started this book as thinking about doing the embodied experience of both women and men, because traditionally I'm a gender historian, a women's historian. And so I started I had the dead body chapter, and then I wrote a chapter, which I'm pretty much finished, about women resistance members in France and how they use their bodies as weapons. They weaponize their bodies. You know, they used it for seduction of German officers to get intelligence. They used their bodies to hide documents and hide weapons. There was one woman who had a bomb in each of her sleeves and her coat, and she just hugged herself the whole time she was on the train so that the bombs wouldn't fall out. So I got really interested in how, what I call the female body of war. And then as I started to write this book as well, chapters, I realized this book needs to be its own book, that the themes were so different. So now I'm writing the female part of the book. And it's going to be, there's a chapter on Italy, there's a chapter on England, and there's a chapter on France. So we'll see how that turns out, but it was a different book, which is why I separated the two.
Yeah, well, that sounds great, and looking forward to reading that when it comes out. Yeah. So anyways, thank you very much, and thank you to the listeners. Bye.
Okay, thank you again for your interest in my work. And the book, again, is called Sheer Misery, and it's sold by the University of Chicago Press. And it's only about 150 pages. It's a good read.
It is, but it's really fascinating. There's so many great insights.
Thanks. Yep. Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.